Okay, let's get started. Today is the essentially last lecture of the learning strand. Next Tuesday we will have a little bit of a recap of the whole learning strand, and there will be opportunities for you to ask questions. I believe after Easter there will be one lecture, review lecture essentially, with both KK and myself. I'm not sure whether physically here at the same time, but there will be something. But I'm not sure when it's happening yet. So, more multi-layer neural networks. Okay, so we're spending a considerable amount of time on neural networks, and the reason why we're spending a considerable amount of time is that they are an example of a very important paradigm in machine learning, which is the discriminative paradigm, which essentially tells you, instead of modeling the whole generative structure of the data, so the whole distribution underlying the likelihood for each class, just focus your effort in learning a good way of partitioning the data by learning generally a fewer parameters model, which just tells us where is the division boundary, essentially, what's the geometry of the system. And we've seen that if you start with a generative model, that implies a discriminative model often. Like in the Gaussian case with equal covariance, it implied a linear decision boundary. And then we could go on and just say, OK, let's just model planes that give us the decision boundary, or model linear discriminant functions. And we then moved further and showed how these could be made into an analogy with a network structure whereby inputs would be connected to outputs by edges that are weighted. Of course, we spent some time on that, and we came to the conclusion, though, that even if we introduced activation functions and did slightly more refined things, we would always end up with linear decision boundaries, which is a very simple structure. So what we did, we introduced an additional layer. So instead of having bipartite graph between inputs and outputs, we introduced a layer of hidden units, and we had a tripartite graph in some sense, where there were three groups with edges only connecting one group to the other, number one to number two, and number two to number three. And the advantages of these were two. One is that it gives us a much more flexible representation, so it allows us, in fact, to have an extremely flexible set of discriminant functions, perhaps too flexible, one could argue, and we will see. But the other major advantage of this specific architecture was that the fact that each bit of the network was still bipartite gave us a very good algorithm for calculating the gradients of the error function. So the gradients were composed of two parts, gradients with respect to the, perhaps it's not a bad idea if I show you a figure, actually. Which one was this? Yeah, okay. Yeah, so there are weights in two places here. There are weights between inputs and hidden, and weights between hidden and outputs. And we saw that the gradient with respect to the weights between hidden and outputs was exactly of the same form as the gradients of the error function for a single layer neural network. But then the gradients with respect to the error to the weights in the inputs to hidden were also quite similar, except that instead of having to consider the error signal at this level, we had to consider the error signal at this level, which was computed from here. So that was the so-called back propagation of the errors. Okay? So it told us that this particular structure of the network gave us the fact that the gradients with respect to the weights were essentially very similar. There were an error signal at the upper layer times the inputs. In this case, the inputs would be the hidden. So for these, it was just the actual error signal of the network times the hidden states. And for these, it was the error signal at the hidden level, which can be worked out in terms of the error signals at the upper level times the inputs. Okay. So it gave us a very effective algorithm to compute the gradients. Okay, so one bit was very similar to single layer neural net, except we had hidden instead of inputs. And the other bit was also very similar to the single layer neural nets, except that this was now the error signal at the hiddens, which is computed in terms of the weights between outputs and hiddens and the error signal at the outputs. Okay? So that's what we did. What we're going to do today, which is going to be slightly less dense as a lecture than the last few ones, is we're going to look at an example in a little bit of detail. Okay, it's a worked out example and it shows you the type of performance. But the thing that I'm keen for you to appreciate is the level of parametrization that is required in this type of models, of neural network models. So the flexibility of having a very general type of division boundary comes at the cost of introducing hidden units and hence introducing a substantial number of extra parameters. And we'll see how many extra parameters we introduce. And in general, what happens is that few hidden units don't buy you very much. You need to put quite a few hidden units. So that's one cost, many more parameters. And the second cost is that what was a nice convex optimization problem in the linear neural network with a single layer becomes a very complicated non-convex problem with lots and lots and lots of local optima. So good guarantees in terms of our gradient descent algorithm to end up in as good a place as possible do not exist. So how do we make sure that we don't just fit to the training data but get an excellent fit to the training data and be and then perform abysmally on any test data? Well, that's what is called the generalization problem. So you don't want a learning algorithm that just learns by rote, so to speak, just learns to pass the exam and knows that the exam is going to be a subset of what he has seen. You want an algorithm that learns from the training data and, given supposedly a reasonably similar problem, which is not in the training data, still manages to do well. So that's what is called generalization, being able to have a good performance on examples that have not been seen before. Okay, so this was, again, the figure of the multilayer perceptron, the two layers perceptron in this case. And again, perceptron is a completely, you know, there's a lot of historical baggage in the names of these algorithms. So don't ask me why it's called perceptron, but there are books that will tell you, and certainly Wikipedia does. And as we've seen, the output signal, Y, which is what we then compare to the target signal, is given by a certain activation function of a weighted combination of the hiddens, Z, which themselves in turn are an activation function applied to a linear combination of the inputs. And there's some reasonably complex jargon here. So as I said, K is the index of the outputs, J is the index of the hiddens, and I is the index of the inputs, and then the hiddens are generally called, the hidden units state is called Z. The signal, so the combined inputs that one hidden unit sees, is called B, and the combined, let's say, effect from the lower parts of the net that one output node sees is called A. Okay. Now, of course, these names are totally arbitrary, but I believe they're fairly widely used in the neural network community and in the neural network literature. So if you pick up, say, a book like Chris Bishop's book on neural networks for pattern recognition, which is one of the books recommended,
it will use a very similar notation to this. Okay. And again, here is just recapping what I said. You know, you build the error function by computing the errors on every single training sample. N is the index of the training samples. And then the gradients with respect to the two sets of weights are given by the sum of the gradients of each error with respect to the two sets of weights. And the way in which we can compute these derivatives is by backpropagation, okay? So the algorithm, which we saw last Tuesday, can be again summarized basically by a gradient descent procedure. So you start with a guess, maybe an informed guess, for your weights, both at the input to hidden and the hidden to output layer. Then you compute the error. Then you compute the error signal for each output unit, which is given by the derivative of G times, well, it's given by the formula that you know. You evaluate these error signals for each hidden unit using backpropagation. That gives you this term. And then that gives you the gradient with respect to the input to hidden units. The gradient of the hidden to output is already calculated from the error signals of the outputs. And of course, like all gradient descents, once you have the gradient, that tells you the direction you need to go down, because it's the steepest direction locally, is the one that gives you the greatest reduction in your cost function. And all you need to do is just to start with a guess and update the weights by subtracting a vector that is proportional to the gradient. And the proportionality constant is called the learning rate. Again, it's called the learning rate only in the machine learning community, and specifically in the neural network community. I guess the optimization community uses a different term. But it's called the learning rate because essentially it tells you the speed at which you are increasing the accuracy of your network. So the speed at which your network is learning. And of course, if you have a learning rate, if you try to learn too fast, then you may actually learn something wrong, and you may overshoot the position of your minimum of the cost function and end up with a suboptimal solution, or possibly even an oscillating solution, okay, so that you don't actually converge anywhere. Okay, so there is one more subtlety, perhaps. Now, having said that gradient descent is the way you train networks, that is true, but there are multiple flavors of gradient descent. And as I said, neural networks, multi-layer neural networks, are not convex optimization problems. Now, if you talk with anyone, non-convex, most people, once they hear the word non-convex, they stop using that model and they look for a convex model that is similar, because it is difficult and it's really hard to optimize non-convex functions. There are no guarantees that you will ever end up in the optimum. Now, neural networks were so successful that people used them for many years, and people still use them. And since they do perform well, people have been motivated to try to find, let's say, a spell book of how to optimize these non-convex functions, okay? And there are many, many, many tricks in the trade. In fact, sometimes it's very difficult to re-implement neural networks papers and get the same results, because sometimes the initialization, so how you start with the initial guess of W, is not described fully enough for you to be able to actually realize that if you start with a real guess, so a random guess, you end up somewhat abysmal, but you need a really rather clever way of starting your initial network. But anyway, one of the simplest tricks, I wonder why that one gets a little bit cut, but that one doesn't. Anyway, one of the simplest tricks is to use a stochastic update. Okay,
So the gradient descent, do you know what stochastic means? No. Some do, some, okay, you tell us then. Random, yeah. So stochastic,
if you have generally a stochastic process is a collection of random variables that depend on time. Okay. So here there is a time component in the sense that you do your updates sequentially, and instead of always doing the prescribed update, you can introduce an element of randomness, and that sometimes helps. So if I do follow this, given a starting point, I will always go down the same route, and I will always end up in the same point, which may not be a great place to end up, but it's where I end up. Okay, if I know what the learning rate is, and I start from the same place, this is a perfectly deterministic algorithm. Given an error function, start an optimization from a fixed initial point with a certain learning rate will take you exactly to the same place if you do it twice. What you could do, and of course, how many times do we need to do calculations? You see, each gradient, okay, each gradient is the sum of the gradients with respect to each error signal. Okay? So each time we do a gradient step, in fact, we have to compute n gradients. Okay? So at every time in gradient descent, you do a step, you recompute your gradient, okay? Because the gradient is a function, usually. If you are in the simple realm where you can compute it analytically, then that's easy. But in general, you know, you compute it numerically, so at every step you recompute the gradient. And computing the gradients of a neural network is a hard job, because if you have to classify 10,000 points, then you have to do 10,000 operations at every single step in your gradient descent. Now, of course, that's the correct thing to do, but it may take you a very long time. What stochastic gradient descent does, it essentially assumes that on average, if you have a large number of time of data points, the error signals should go roughly in the same direction. So if you had a very good model, if your neural network was a really good model, then the fact that you are not in the optimal weight position should basically affect all the points pretty much in the same direction. So it's hoping that the error signals that you get from each training point pair is not giving you completely contrasting messages. So the idea is, instead of computing the gradient of every single error function and adding it up, which involves n operations, you just update the neural network on a few samples, on a few examples, okay? This is a simplistic way that is maybe dangerous, or just choosing at random one example for each step of gradient descent and computing the gradient on that example. But what you could do is, for example, compute the gradient on 1% of randomly selected input-output pairs. And if your training set size was large enough to cause you trouble in computing n operations at every step, if you take 1%, it is a small fraction, but you're likely to get roughly a good picture of where the gradient should go. Okay. So the idea is you modify the algorithm instead of applying the n input vectors for the training set, you select at random a subset of fixed length of training points and optimize that error, okay? And then carry on. And in this way, of course, you know, you're not getting the right, the true gradient, but anyway, the problem is so complicated and multimodal that sometimes the true gradient wouldn't help you. So in fact, in terms of empirical evaluation, stochastic gradient descent does pretty much as well, if not better than gradient descent, than standard gradient descent, at a fraction of the cost. And again, I said that, as I said, the reason is that basically, if you have a large number of n, you know, you should expect that if you take a few samples, that will give you a reasonably good idea of where to go. It won't be exactly the right idea. The convergence may be slightly more noisy, so that you don't always go down in the exact maximal direction. But you would hope that the stochastic gradient is around the true gradient. It's not pointing in a completely opposite direction. It doesn't come with guarantees. And I'm afraid a lot of machine learning doesn't come with guarantees. Particularly neural networks do not come with any guarantees. But you know, there are two types of people, the ones that want guarantees and the ones that want things that work. And sometimes they intersect, but not always. So this would be a very simple example. Okay, so how do we do computations here? Okay, so this is the pieces of data that we have here are the inputs. Okay, of course, the bias value, the value corresponding to the bias nodes, which are these blue nodes, is always clamped to 1. Okay, so the bias is permanently on. We have 3 input values. Okay, and we have 2 output values. So this would be, what type of classification problem is this? Yeah, how do we call these type of classification problems with discriminant functions with 2 values? It's one of the favorite words of computer scientists. Binary, yes, it's a binary classification problem. It is 1 or 2 classes, okay? Easy peasy. And we have 3-dimensional inputs, okay? So we have 3 inputs. And we want to decide that the target value, in fact, it's a binary variable, you know? It's 0, 1, okay? And the particular case that corresponds to this input, you know, in the ideal scenario, it's in class, in this class, okay? In the right-hand class. Because its target value is 1 for the right-hand class and is 0 for the left-hand class. And then all of these black numbers here are weights, okay? There is 1 number per edge. And these are random initializations, okay? So if we take, so how do we get this 0.68 value? So what we need to do is to take 1, multiply by 1, 0.5, multiply by 0.5, that's 1 point, and add 1.25, and then 0.5 and multiply by 1, and add again, 1.75. That would give us the plus, and then there is the little sigmoid function, which is 1 over 1 plus exponential minus a, okay? So if we do this minus or plus, I can't remember in this moment, it doesn't really matter. If we do this sequence of operations, then we get a hidden unit value of 0.68. Now, that's good. You know, if you got 1.3, I would have been upset, because we've introduced these activation functions to be able to interpret these values as probabilities, so they have to be between 0 and 1. Now, what we don't do, we don't normalize across the two. So if we take, and of course, we should take this 1, multiply by minus 1, and add it. So we would have got 0.75 in the end. And similarly here, we take the 3 input values, multiply each of them by their own weight. So here we would have minus 0.5, minus 0.5, 0.5, in total is minus 0.5. We take the bias value, multiply it by its weight, minus 0.5, get minus 1, and we get 1 over 1 plus e to the minus minus 1, and in fact, we get a slightly smaller value here.
We get 0.27.
So these now are the z values. Notice what I'm doing is propagating forward. Forward goes from input to output. And that's what you do to compute the output of the neural network, given weights and inputs. And I repeat the same thing here. I take this value, multiply by its weight, and put it here, and sum with this value, multiply by its weight, sum with the bias, multiply by its weight, and pass it through the squashing function, and I get a certain value, 0.24 and 0.39. Now, what is the first thing I need to do now? Okay, this is just forward propagation. Okay. What do I need to do now? If I want to train this network, of course. Back propagation. At some stage, I will need to do back propagation, but do I need to do it now? Yeah. So what's the Why would I want to normalize these results? I don't think I want to normalize these results. You don't generally normalize. What we could do, we could consider a single output neural network here, because it's a binary problem, so we could take the difference. But that's, in general, what we want to do is to compute how far we've gone. Okay, so we have our target values, 0 and 1, and then we have our output values, which are some way off. So we need to take this minus this and square it, and this minus and this and square it, and sum those. And that's the error produced by the network. Okay? And that's the first thing. I need the error signals. So I need each error of each output before I can start to do back propagation. Because I need these error signals, multiply them by these, and that gives me the gradient with respect to these. And then I do back propagation of the errors to get the error signals at the hidden level, multiply by the input, and get the gradient with respect to these. So that's the procedure, okay? You start with a guess, forward propagate. You forward propagate because you want to compute the error you're making with that guess, okay? You want to see how far off you are with your guess. Then you compute the error, and once you got that, you got the signals that you backpropagate. Okay, so that's what I would be doing, and that's the error. Then, of course, this gives me the error signals, but the error signals are not so simple, because there is a derivative of the activation function involved as well, okay? So there are a few formulae that need to be known. But that's what I would do, okay? I compute the error, then I compute the error signal, which, if you recall, we don't have it in this. We have it in last week, in Tuesday's lecture, but the error signal involves the derivative of the activation function. We compute these error signals, and then we compute the gradients with respect to each of the weights. Okay. And then, once we have that, once we have this gradient with respect to these weights, we can update the weight, okay? Update the weight by subtracting its gradient. Here we have a learning rate. What's the learning rate here if we update W to be 2.0004? Okay, you see, I've computed this gradient here, okay, by taking the error message, the error signal, the input, zero point 0.27 is the hidden.
0.14 is that. But you're right, it's the last thing that is left. So it's 0.1. Okay. So I take the error signal, I multiply by the lower level value. Says up there where? Ha! There you go. Great. So that's good. Fantastic. So there you go. That's true. Eta is equal to 0.1. That gives us a delta W, which is not the gradient. It's the step that we're going to make, 0.04. And we get an update for our weight in this way. So these ingredients, hiddens and error rate, error signals at the outputs are sufficient to do an update of the weights at the higher level. If you want to update the weights at the lower level, we then have to compute the error signal here, and that is where we do backpropagation. And we do exactly the same thing. So eta again 0.1, and this, and so far. Now, of course, I haven't showed you all the computations. Because to do all the computations, to compute this error signal at the level of the hidden, I have to compute, I have to backpropagate not just the error along this edge, but the error along the other edge. So I have to sum the backpropagated error from both output values. Okay, but you can't fit all the computations onto the slide. But I think it would be very useful for your own education, which is what you're here for, of course, to do these computations yourself. They're not very difficult computations. You just need to know the derivative of the exponential and the chain rule. Okay, and then that gives me an update for the weights. Okay, and that's a small update again. So, in some sense, this was probably a reasonably good, despite the fact that we had very, very wrong errors, very wrong outputs. You see, the gradients are fairly small. They get, we have a fairly high learning rate. 0.1 is quite a high learning rate, to be honest. And the gradient terms are very small. So, with a little bit of tweaking of the edges, we can probably get quite a good prediction. Okay, so if we were to do this on a real data set, well, then things would become a little bit more difficult. So this is the data set we examined for classification with Gaussians. This is the vowel data set. And it consists of a fair number of classes, 6, 8, 10. And the training set is a fairly large number of points, although possibly not quite as large as to require stochastic gradient descent. You may be able to do it with standard gradient descent. Of course, if we do this, we wouldn't do it by hand. First of all, because how many output classes do we have in this case? How many output nodes do we have? I heard a number that sounded plausible. Ten. We have 10 output nodes. We have one output node per class, unless we are in a binary case and we may want to shrink down to one. And we have two input variables, so it's going to be a fairly complex system to deal with. If we put Gaussians, as we have done, we would get these Gaussians. These are general Gaussians. They're not forced to have the same covariance. Let's see how things work. So we could try to train a Gaussian classifier, a two-dimensional Gaussian classifier. Okay. So two-dimensional Gaussian classifier, you need, for the in the general case, you need two parameters for the mean and three parameters for the covariance, because the covariance has to be symmetric. So you need 5 parameters per class. In total, you get 50 parameters. If we wanted to use a single layer neural network, then we would have 10 outputs and 2 inputs. So we would have, remember, a single layer neural network, you always have the bias as well, which has to be connected with each of the outputs. So you have 10 weights for the bias, and then you have 10 weights per input. So we have 30 parameters in total. Now, an MLP, to get a decent MLP, a good MLP, you can't have 2 hidden units. So in this case, we went for 25 hidden units. And now notice the number is quite different, you know, it's 335 parameters. Yeah. I suggest you toss the dice for 20 times and sum the values. There is no clear reason. I mean, this is, there is a lot of engineering here. People would try, but we'll see how to do it in a minute. Well, that's the same question. So how do you choose the number of hidden units? Yeah, let's see what we do. Well, how do you train that? How do we train a neural network? Yeah, so that's we'll get back to that. Okay, so we do some pre-processing, and then we can carry on. And if we do that, we see that, you know, in this case, the MLP was rather disappointing. Okay, so it gets the same results as the Gaussian classifier. Only slightly better than the single-layer network, which is equivalent to a Gaussian classifier where you clamp all of the covariances to be the same. These are the decision regions. The single-layer neural network, of course, they are piecewise linear decision regions. And the multi-layer perception has got more complex decision regions. Okay, so that's the problem. Okay, so let's see, how many data points did I have? This is a fair amount of data points. It's probably about 500. But if I had 200 training instances and I was trying to learn 335 parameters, then you should immediately think there is something wrong here. So I'll show you an example. So suppose you're doing a regression problem now. You have a target value that is continuous. Okay. If you try to fit these with a line, you'll get a reasonable fit, or a bad fit. You may decide it's not a reasonable fit, but you'll get a fit of sorts, and you will get a value of the error function. If you try to fit these with a quadratic function, so here I have essentially y, which is my variable that I want to regress onto the x-axis. Okay, I want to learn the map x to y. And then let's say we suppose that y is a polynomial of order n in x. This is a trivial example. If I wanted to use a quadratic polynomial, I would probably get something like this. A different fit. Now I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 points. Now, if I wanted to use a degree 5 polynomial, what value of the error would I get? Sorry?
A
Well, yes, if I want to optimize it. Yeah, get zero. Of course. So I could say that y was, you know, such that it went through all the points. So if I apply the suggestion of, you know, trying several different values of hidden units and see which one gives me the lowest error, very soon I will get that I get almost, that I get everything perfect. Because these are very flexible values. But then, okay, I can get a polynomial that does this. Goes through all the points. But then I get an extra point that is here. Now my line does reasonably well. And the polynomial to get everything perfect could do disastrously badly. This is called overfitting. So I'm fitting too much the data. Okay. And the problem of selecting a model, so this is exactly the problem that we were mentioning before. We don't want something that does really well on what it has seen already, because then I can just use the data. You know, I have that data. I know what's the value of y corresponding to that value of x. We want something that, given a different value of x that has not been seen, does well. And that's the problem of generalization. Now, how do we do generalization? That's a big problem. So how many hidden units or how many weights, equivalently, do we need? The idea of generalization, you know, the idea behind most model selection techniques is to improve your performance over something that you've not seen. Okay? You could have two scenarios. One is the overfitting scenario, where you have a flexible network, a very flexible network that will predict practically perfectly the training data, but then you don't know how it would fit new data. Or you could have a non-flexible network. So you could have said here that the line was a bad fit, but maybe it's actually the best fit that you can possibly come up with. So the idea is that you should keep a subset of your data aside. So, of course, everyone would like to be able to say this will predict, will do very well on unseen test data. But how do you evaluate that? So the simplest approach is what is called cross-validation, okay? So in practice, cross-validation, what it will do is a way of splitting the data and maintaining essentially a subset of the data where you know the true answer, but you don't use for training the model. Okay? So your data would essentially be split into a training set, and this is what would be called the cross-validation set. So on the training set, you run your model, you optimize your parameters. On the validation set, you see how the model that did best with the parameters that did best on the training set does on the validation set. Since it's not seen the validation set for training, this is a fairly unambiguous scenario. So it's a fairly unbiased approach. And what you would do, you would do many, many, many different splits. Okay. So to answer your question of the hidden units, what you probably would do, you would do one split into training and validation set, and you would try, let's say, four different models, 10, 15, 20, 25 hidden units. You would evaluate the errors. So we would have models 1 to 4, model 1, model 2, model 3, model 4. Each of them you optimize the weights by backpropagation on the training set, and then you get a validation set 1, and you get a certain error. and so on and so forth. Then you do another split, and you get another column in here. And then you evaluate, you compute on average which model did best at generalizing on the unseen validation set. That's a very well defined procedure. What is an obvious disadvantage of this procedure?
It will take a while.
It will take a while, yeah, that's one. Anyone else had other ideas? I heard people mumbling on this side as well. I mean, there is also a problem that if you have a large data set, then you can do it. You always need, you know, if your data set was of size, you know, it had 200 training points, you know, you can't really go and evaluate complex models, okay? So you can't split, you can't realistically do cross-validation on small training sets. That, in many cases, is actually a problem. Because you need always to split the data, but you must make sure that you retain a sufficient number of data to meaningfully train your models to start off with. And that can be a big problem in many cases. But certainly the computational intensivity of it is another big problem. But what is a remedy to the fact that it will take a while? Yeah, what, so, you know, if you do this, you have to do, you know, 20 splits, 20 different splits between test, training, and validation. You have four models, you have to do 80 times training and evaluation. And that may take some time. So what would you say? Yeah, buy a bigger computer.
We all have lots of nodes, so that's not a problem. It's a totally parallelizable approach. So
it takes some time, but it's not such a big problem. But if you have small data sets, it is a big problem. You can't do it conceptually. Okay, so this is the slide with the corresponding explanation. So this is the procedure. Okay, you split the data into training, validation, and then you you evaluate the performance on the validation set, and you select the model that performs best on the validation set. On average, you typically do it many times. Okay. Now, this is another piece of trickery, neural networks, dark magic called overtraining. So basically, some people would say, okay, you may have a very, very flexible model, and if you really go to the minimum, you get an error function that is zero and that is bad. But then don't do it. Just stop before you have converged. Now, there isn't any good reason why that would be something sensible to do it. Okay, but if you're starting with a fifth-order polynomial and you're training it by gradient descent on this data, then you will probably start with something that is not so closely fitting. Okay. And if you stop before you've gone to the zero, you will get something that is not so closely fitting. The reason why this slide is here is that people actually do this and have done it. So the idea is that you could do it in the you could do it in so this is what I'm referring to, early stopping, okay? You could do it if you have a validation set. So the idea of early stopping, you still have a training set where you could achieve perfect results. But at the same time, you monitor the performance on the validation set. Okay, so if you were to do the complete training of the neural network maybe you would end up with something that monotonically decreases the error function on the training set, but then starts to increase the error function on the validation set. So if you train by gradient descent with the gradients computed on the training set, but at the same time monitor the error on the validation set, then you could assume what is the optimal place to stop. Okay. People do it. There is no strong mathematical, statistical reason for doing it, but it's a piece of engineering that sometimes works. See, the key bit is the last bullet point. Very effective. People that want to get,
you know, an increase in performance often are very happy to
obtain it through dark magic, essentially. And there isn't a reason why this works, but it does. Another thing that people do is, and this is much more principled, is what is called weight decay. Okay, so this effectively, for the people that will go on to do some more machine learning, is the principle behind regularization or behind Bayesian approaches. So you start saying, at the moment, our weights are just estimated by optimization. But we could say we don't want the weights to be too big, or we don't want the weights to be too far from one, or something like that. So we could put in the optimization function a penalty for having too many big weights. That's what is called the regularization. Okay. So that essentially the network will be forced to have weights that are not too big, and that will constrain its flexibility. Okay. In the early days it was called weight decay, nowadays it's called more closely regularization. And that is the same idea. Essentially, we would have a data term and we would add a penalty if we get too many weights that are too big. Okay. This can be seen as a prior term, but forget about that for the time being. Okay. So for example, we could choose the complexity term to be of this quadratic form, and that means basically you don't want any weights to become very large. Okay. It does correspond this to a Gaussian, zero-mean Gaussian prior on the weights. And the beauty of this is that it's got a very simple derivative, so we still compute the gradients in a very easy way. Just do back propagation, but add this term. If you did physics at A levels, or whatever you did at school, basically you will recall that this is the potential function of a spring. So the analogy that was put here of putting a spring on the weights is apt. You know, if a weight wants to become big, the force from the data must be very strong because it's pulling against the spring. Okay, so all you do, you know, in physics, in mechanics, is optimizing potential, and that's exactly the same thing we're doing here. We're optimizing an error function. If we include that, as I said, you know, you do exactly the same thing. You do back propagation. These are the bits that come from back propagation. We compute it exactly in the same ways, but you also have to add the gradient of the regularization term, and this could be very simple. And that's about all I'm going to say today. So we've seen an example of how we do back propagation in practice. I do recommend in that toy example with two outputs, three inputs, you actually do some calculations on a piece of paper. And we've seen of the potential pitfalls of neural networks. They're very highly parameterized. It's very difficult to do model selection, to select the number of hidden units, because they are introduced just to increase the performance, but there isn't a physical reason for having a certain amount of hidden units. And a solution to both model selection and to avoid overfitting goes towards the direction of controlling how well the network generalizes. So keeping a part of the data out for evaluating the performance on unseen data.
Okay, so on Tuesday we'll go basically through the whole course in half an hour, and then you'll have half an hour to ask questions and so on. Okay?
No lectures on Thursday and Friday.
Oh, no, I've never said that, did I? There's another person that lectures.